Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, assistant professor of systematic theology, Dr. Ronnie Kurtz.
I'm so glad that intro begins with friend. I'll be worried one day when you're like, I'm with my co-host.
if we're on the outs.
Yeah, that's right.
You'll know. Yeah. If we're on the outs, because I'll say, and I'm here with Dr. Ronnie Kurtz.
With this guy.
Like, whatever this guy is, we got to do this. I've heard through a little birdie, which is you, that you have some beef. No, so like normally I'm the guy who brings in complaints.
Yeah.
The infamous stubborn banana.
The hardest I've ever laughed on this podcast.
Waiters, it was a great way to start the suffering episode.
Oh my God.
Because people were suffering through that. But waiters and waitresses who don't write down the order.
You hate that. I'm not impressed.
I can't stand that.
Yeah.
But you said, well, you're not a beef guy because you're Mr. Get Along Gang, but enough things have begun to accumulate. You're like George Bailey, just getting, you know, confidence being eroded in Bedford Falls by one little thing. It's like the water torture.
That's exactly right.
So apparently you've got some beef.
Yeah, so for older listeners, they'll know this is a little unique because of what you said. I'm just... I don't know if you and Ross did beefs.
You're getting older is what it is.
That is exactly what it is, Jared. I'm a little worried about it. Jared used to do this, bit on our show where he would just start
Jared's
something
beefs.
With like, you know what grinds my gears? Yeah. And he would talk about everything that bothers him. And I don't know, I guess I just didn't have them. And Jared teased me about being a part of the Get Along Gang. But I've got a few. Mm. They're snowballing. They're not big. None of them are big, which is how it should be.
A few beefs are snowballing.
Yeah, here they are. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I have started to dislike these things pretty strongly.
Okay.
One, people who don't put their carts back.
Who don't put their carts back?
Carts back.
Oh, at the grocery store.
At the grocery store. It's just like, it's the lowest common denominator of you being a good human. Like, if you can't even do this, we gotta deal with this. So now
I've got a solution for that, actually.
What is that?
I park close to the cart corral. I don't know why more people don't think about this.
I look
for a space and I almost always find one.
Yeah.
I park at the cart corral and then you don't have to walk a long distance.
Man, there are probably people out there who park close and still don't return it.
Are you talking about returning the cart like into the store?
No. Like, you know how people just like leave it?
They
on
just
the
leave
side.
It.
Like,
man.
It's like that's scumbag that's of the earth stuff, man. Like, come on. There's one. Another one is people who have... and I feel bad because I'm sure some listeners fall into this one. None of our listeners don't return their cart, surely.
Yeah.
Some of our listeners might do this one. I have learned there is a direct correlation between the amount of bumper stickers you have on your car and the likelihood that we won't get along. The more bumper stickers, the more likely I'm probably not going to enjoy your company. Okay. That's just how it works, you know.
Huh.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of bumper stickers?
I don't have any bumper stickers.
Exactly. That's why I love you.
I have a license plate frame.
That's fine.
You know, the little thing that goes around the license plate?
That's fine.
It's a New England Patriots
thing.
It doesn't make a statement of any kind. And then I have the Midwestern parking decals.
Yeah, same.
The other sticker.
Yeah.
I used to have on a previous car, I had our church had
that's great.
Made stickers, and I had a sticker from a church.
Happy with that.
Not a bumper sticker
guy. But it's when
guy.
Like, oh, by looking at your car, I know all of your favorite music and all of your political choices and all, like, you're just a loud person.
I don't get the bumper sticker... do you think has anyone ever changed their mind?
Could you imagine? Like,
because
I've never thought of it that way.
You know what? My favorite politician is a loser.
You've convinced me.
Thank you, bumper sticker.
You've convinced me. All right, two last ones.
Okay.
Overly loud cars.
Yeah.
And people who watch videos out loud without headphones in public. Those are my last two.
Yeah, those are pretty standard kind of curmudgeonly things.
Yeah.
The loud cars, like that's a dad complaint.
Come on,
you know what I mean?
I guess I'm really turning into a dad.
You got little kids, you got,
My wife,
who are you trying to impress, loud car? You know? No one's impressed by that. Oh, we're all real impressed.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great dad one.
When they take off the shoes, like,
mine is, I always go, seems like a nice guy. Or I'll say, some cool guys around here.
Yeah, that's okay. Becky and I usually say something like, who do they think they're impressing?
Yeah.
Like, no one is impressed by that. We're all just annoyed. The phone thing in public, I actually don't get it. I don't understand, because I travel a lot and there are always people on the airplane or in the gate area who, and there's all kinds of other noise happening. So what is so annoying? Because it does annoy me. I'm not saying
it's
not
annoying. Oh, it's so annoying.
But why does it stand out?
Yeah.
Phone or audio from somebody's phone?
I think
phone?
It's because like the other noise, you can't control that. You know, like if you're having a conversation, let's say we're in the airport together.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're having a conversation with another colleague. That's what you should be doing in the airport. You can't control the fact that I'm sitting in proximity to you and able to hear your conversation. That person can.
Okay.
They can control that.
Right.
And there's something about the way the audio sounds through a phone speaker being like played loud. It's like
there is something about it.
It makes me want to set myself on fire. So
I feel the same way. And I've learned it's usually older folks. I wonder if they don't know about headphones.
Hey, like 3 decades ago, we invented this thing.
Well, like they don't have a thing. Like, well, I mean, Apple makes it harder. Like there's not like the phone jack. It's not an auxiliary jack. It's like you got to have the dongle or the AirPod or what you get or something.
Don't even get me started on Bluetooth.
Yeah, that's what's the, that. Well, that it may
that's
have
witchcraft.
It may have something to do with that. That it's getting harder to know how to do that. But it's usually older people who do it, and. I think younger people, I can't figure out. There's like this age gap.
Yeah.
I think, so you're a millennial, right?
I am, yeah.
I think it's millennials and Gen Xers.
We don't do it. Yeah, we don't
like,
do that.
We know that that's a faux pas. Yeah.
One thing we got right. Man.
Can I make one comment about the bumper sticker thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
So my deal, so you say all about loud cars.
Yeah.
What'd you say?
It's like, no, it's just like
a cool guy.
It's your loud. Yeah.
Like that. So this is what I say. When somebody's driving badly, like it's like they're driving really poorly or they're just like really frustrating me with their driving, and then I see their bumper sticker and they support a particular political candidate, I always go figures
is such a universal word. Figures.
The reason they drive poorly is because they're like that,
yeah,
you know,
figures,
they, because they believe that.
Oh, that word. It's the amount of cases you could pull it out. It's like, figures.
Yeah, it's just figures. All right, it's a mailbag episode. Those were good. Those are some good beefs.
Hey,
I like the little constellation of smaller beefs.
I've been storing
them up together into a patty.
Years, man.
It's good. You got like little, it's a patchwork beef. I like that. We got some good questions. These come in from a variety of places, and I'll stay at the front end of the episode. If you'd like to submit a question or a topic for the mailbag, you can email us at mailbag@ftc.co. That's mailbag@ftc.co. I'll repeat that at the end of the episode. Here's our first question. This comes from Austin on Facebook. Austin says, what's your best advice for a first-time senior pastor? Austin is heading in to be a lead pastor. He's taking on his first lead pastorate. What wants to know, what's your best advice?
Yeah. I think you should start this.
Yeah.
I want you to start because I've actually never been a lead pastor.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been a pastor.
Sure.
I pastored a church about 7.5 years, but it was an elder team. We planted the church and I wasn't the one who was like primary preaching. I had another job. So, but you have been a few times.
I mean, I think I would say, Austin, like, don't go in necessarily thinking you've got to make some super big changes in the very beginning, right? Don't overestimate what you can do in the beginning, but just preach faithfully week in and week out and love people, serve them during the week. That combination, I think, will build you a lot of credibility. It will build you a lot of authority, I think. Over time, one of the worst things that a first-time lead pastor can do, or someone, even if they're not the first-time lead pastor, but they're going to a church, a new church, to serve as a lead pastor, they try to change. They may make big changes too soon, and you just being there is a big enough change. Having a new lead pastor, that's a big change for a church, and so there's an adjustment even to your leadership style, to your personality, etc. So the best thing you can do is just provide a steadiness, a stability over the first year, year and a half or so of just faithfully preaching the scriptures week in, week out, and loving and serving people during the week. But, you know, if you're in a context where visitation is a thing, make sure you're doing those visits. You know, get lunches and coffees and just spend time with people so they can get to know you. Don't go in, you know, with your agenda right away in terms of your leadership. Now, if there's things that are just like, man, we've got to fix this because the church is going to have to close its doors or
it's unbiblical
or there's something heretical or something. Yeah, like, yeah, you got to make those changes. But, you know, don't go in thinking of all the stuff you want to change look at them as a family you want to love and get to know.
Yes.
And start off that way. That's the best advice.
Yeah. Dever had that line, Mark Dever, that I think about it quite often, where he said a lot of new pastors overestimate what they can do in 1 year mm-hmm. and underestimate what they can do in 10 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's a good word of like, you're that first year, you're probably not going to get all of the changes you want to make.
Right.
But there is something about a faithful pulpit ministry that if you are giving the people a good meal week in and week out over 10 years,
yeah.
I think 5 years, you'll be shocked at what you could change.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and in the beginning, they'll listen to you if you're a good preacher. You know, they'll in the early days, if they like your preaching, you've got some credibility there. Over time, if they know you as a faithful shepherd, if they know that you love them and serve them well, it almost doesn't matter how good a preacher you are. If you're not a good
yes.
you know, good pastor, they'll tune you out on every level. Mm-hmm. But if you just do those two things, I think over time you build up enough goodwill that when you start introducing the changes that you want to make, you'll find that people yep. you know hear them out a little more charitably and more openly. Okay, this comes from Anonymous via email. Anonymous asks, how should an associate pastor navigate ministry alongside a lead pastor who has a differing ministry philosophy? This is a super common question.
Oh, yes.
And yeah. We have answered it, I think, a number of times, more than once on the podcast. But it's such a perennial question. I'll let you take the lead on this, and I'll see if there's anything
else. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure.
How should an associate pastor navigate ministry alongside a lead pastor who has a differing ministry philosophy?
I'm sure I'm echoing stuff we've said before, but I think it depends. And that feels like a cop-out, but it's not. It depends on what the philosophical difference is.
Yes, that's right.
And this is where like something like theological triage would come into play, of course. But I mean, if it's like a philosophical difference where it's like, we will just never be able to do this, then the answer's kind of obvious. But there is a reality of, you know, is this the kind of thing where I can submit to the other elders and trust their leading? Do they see it as like a hill to die on or as like a, hey, I'm willing to come towards you as well. That's going to change your posture. I think if it's something where you can be around and not so discord and outlive, maybe, you know, maybe it's like, hey, if I was the lead pastor, I wouldn't do it that way.
Right.
And there's a real chance I will be the lead pastor in, you know, 5 or 6 years. And this is something I'm willing to put up with in the interim.
Yeah, right.
As long as it's not like a, I'm going to sow discord and speak poorly about my predecessor right when he's gone or something. Yeah, I think those are kind of basics. What would you add to that?
No, I think there's just so many contingencies there. But if it comes down to, this is a matter of conscience, like, you know, conscience and conviction. It's not just, preference. I would make different decisions. But when he says ministry philosophy, I'm assuming like, it is such a significant direction, vision for ministry that even the choices, and typically this comes up a lot. I hear it a lot from guys that like they're bought in on gospel centrality.
That's
they're,
right.
They're yeah. in a second or third chair in a church that is bought in on attractional,
yes.
you know, very pragmatic ministry. And so let's just assume that's the example. And Anonymous, this may not fit exactly what you're asking, but I want to know a few things, like if by conscience and conviction, like you feel like the direction is unbiblical or just unhealthy, like maybe it's not heretical per se, but it's just not healthy for the church. It's not maturing the church, et cetera. You probably need to leave, like unless you're in a position to influence. And one reason a lot of guys ask the question is because they're not really in
right.
a position to influence. But sometimes they are, like, you know, sometimes a lead pastor is, you know, open to, I guess, having the direction influenced or vision influenced, but usually the question is asked because it's not.
Yeah.
If you see no recourse for change or there is no opportunity for change in the future, like as Ronnie said, hey, maybe you can be the lead guy in a few years and you know that's on the horizon, but if it's all, in stone, so to speak, you probably don't need to be there.
Yeah.
If you know, and I know that's easy for someone to say who's not in the position of like,
yeah.
if you got to move a family or you got to worry about, you know, paying your bills and all those sorts of things. But it's not likely, like the navigate is the navigate is navigate away.
Yeah.
Is to go someplace that, because you're not in a position to set that vision.
Mm-hmm.
And if the roles were reversed in some way, if you had a, let's say you were the senior pastor and you were setting the vision for gospel centrality or just for a healthy, you know, biblical ministry, and you had a youth pastor or an associate pastor who was all sold out on, we need to do seeker sensitive,
yeah,
or consumeristic, or
this is
we
a good
need
point.
To do props or whatever. How would you feel they were constantly trying to like steer you away?
You'd probably be like, just leave.
Yeah, you'd be like, why don't you leave and go to a church where you would feel comfortable? So that's probably what you should do. But if you're just not able to do that, what can you do except, you know, pray a lot and learn what you can? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there will be an opening at some point for you to either leave or to influence in your present circumstance. What are the things that you can learn in that context? You know, figure those things out. That's, you know, usually where I go.
Absolutely.
I go. Okay, this comes from Les on Facebook. Les asks, so it's not a question, he just gives us the topic, dealing with criticism in the church. Dealing with criticism in the church. And I feel like we did an episode on this kind of recently, maybe. Or we talked about disappointment.
Yeah.
But maybe we've talked about criticism as well. But maybe just one, two, or three bullet points related to dealing with criticism.
It was something that a pastor that I pastored with in the early days of Emmaus, it was a practice that he had. And he, you know, it's not overly brilliant, but when he said it, it was like really helpful for me. And it's not overly theological, but pretty practical. We had a member bring something against the elders, a pretty strong criticism. And it just happens to be
this that almost sets up the next question, but
okay, yeah, it just happened to be that. Oh, that's true. Yeah, that day the elders were all doing a lunch together, and this was a lunch we had scheduled to be strictly hang out and enjoy one another's company, which we don't get to do enough. And before we could do that in good conscience, we just had to talk about the criticism. And the lead pastor at the time said, "Let's do this. Let's ask this about the criticism." He said, "Let's fit it into one of these three categories. One, the criticism is true and there's something I need to repent of. Two, the criticism is largely untrue, but perception matters and I need to be aware of something.
Okay.
Or three, the criticism is so untrue, I should just move on."
Yeah.
I actually have found those three categories to be quite helpful. In my opinion, even when very few things fall into category three for me, maybe it's my own insecurity, but I know there's other people who are like, "Yeah, right, they're wrong. I'm always right." That's not me. Almost always going to say there's something to change, there's something to tweak, or at least there's something that I might not have been in the wrong, but the way that I said it, or the way that my tone was, or the way that I approached that person or didn't approach that person, there's something here to be learned. Mm. I would say 80% of things fall into that category two for me.
Yeah.
20% fall into category one, 0% falls into category three. But that little, you know, taxonomy has been helpful for me.
Yeah. Can I tell you my journey with criticism in the church, particularly as a pastor, I should say, I guess, in the early days of ministry, or just the early days of even just my Christian life, even before like vocational ministry, when somebody would criticize me, I'm in the "You're a jerk, you're wrong, I'm always right"
kind of stage. Really?
Like I wouldn't say I'm always right.
That surprises me about you. But I was
very defensive.
Yeah.
And I just was a young man who like really, you know, and I thought deeply and thought a lot about things. And so like I was always defensive.
Yeah.
And would reject criticism and, you know, even if secretly I thought they probably are onto something or that may be true, I would kind of put the wall up and I would utterly reject it. When I went through kind of my gospel wakefulness experience and then into ministry after that, I think I went the pendulum swing the other way, which is I just owned everything. And certainly there were times where I probably was maybe a little terse if I just, you know, was at the end of my rope with criticism. But by and large, I just carried it like, "Oh, you got a brick for me to put in my backpack? Okay."
Yeah.
And
I'm
walking around with a backpack full of bricks, you know, even though some of them were given to me years previous. You know, mm-hmm. I was too far the kind of doormat.
Woe is me.
Kind of thing. Yeah. And I, you know, I was in a church too at one point where I had elders who were not super helpful.
Uh-huh.
They didn't protect me in that way either. And we, behind closed doors, they would support me, but then out in the field, that I was just on my own taking arrows from every direction. And so that's not great. I'm in a stage of life now where I can do I'm very comfortable. Well, I'm not comfortable with criticism, but it feels more natural to do what you said. And like, is there something useful in this?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have anything to protect anymore. I don't feel like, you know, at least in terms of like my feelings or whatever. I'm mm-hmm. just like, man, the worst stuff has been done and said.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
This is nothing. You know what I mean? In the grand scheme of things, like, I'm sorry that this, you know, this is a big deal for you, but but for me, I'm like, you know. But what that does is it frees me up to go, oh yeah, I screwed up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, you're right. Even if I think like they're doing it the wrong way or they're coming with the wrong tone or what have you, I think the Lord has equipped me over time to be able to just honestly go, okay, even if I think most of what you're saying is wrong, there's something in it I can learn from. Maybe it's the optical thing, even,
yeah,
too.
That's
it's
right.
Like, oh, the impression matters. And so I just need to be on guard about that, or I should really, you know, is there an area I need to repent of? Or I just feel like I'm quicker to kind of go there. At the same time, when something is just like utterly untrue, I don't feel any, like, I don't get angry, I don't get defensive
like,
in that way. But I have not had a problem in my later years of going, I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah.
think that's correct. Yeah. I don't get animated about it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to like be mean to anybody or anything like that. But when somebody like makes a charge or a criticism, I don't have any compunction now of sort of gently saying, I don't believe that's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And doing it just like that. Where in the early days I would be like, oh, man, I gotta come in.
Yeah.
You know, here's the
defend
list
yourself.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So I don't feel like I have to defend myself, but I'm willing to, like, I'm not going to be a doormat for every, you know, preferential thing that somebody comes up with or criticism that somebody comes up with. So Les, I guess, is asking for advice. I would say take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Is there something you can learn in that criticism? Maybe it's largely untrue or it's exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the person who is bringing it is not bringing it in a correct way. And that's something to address at some point. But in general, like, what can you learn from that criticism? And maybe you're weak in areas that you don't realize that you're weak in. You don't exactly believe what they think you believe, or you didn't exactly do what they said you did, but you could see how maybe they got there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's a learning opportunity there as well. But also don't, you know, the other piece of advice would just be, don't own criticism to the extent that, like, you're not handing it to the Lord, that you're letting it erode your assurance, that you're letting it, you know, kind of jostle your security in Christ, who you are in Him. But you know, in general, like, if somebody is a critical spirit, then the other angle is that's something to actually, I think, pastorally address. I don't remember if Les is a pastor or if he's even speaking, but that's typically where these questions are coming from.
Yeah.
It's, you know, obviously you will have congregants who criticize each other and those sorts of things. But, you know, if there's a way to address somebody who is a constant critic, this seems to be their mode of operation.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you need to address that as well. Hey, has it occurred to you that, you know, you're more of a discourager than an encourager? It's occurred to us. And so let's talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, don't be afraid to do that either, Les. You know, don't be afraid of feeling like you're being vindictive or defensive, unless you are being vindictive or defensive. But there is the appropriate place for pastoral correction in this area too. The devil doesn't need any advocates in the church, right? Okay. This comes from Dan on Facebook. Dan says, what recourse do Baptist members have when sinned against by their elders? I may be mistaken, he says, but this seems to be a baked-in advantage our Presbyterian brothers have. And I think he's speaking to the idea that, like, when elders are in sin, or, you know, there's a presbytery in Presbyterian churches, or there's an outside accountability that can remove them. But Dan is at least assuming that there is not that recourse in Baptist churches. And I would say that that's not exactly true. It depends on the Baptist church, I suppose.
Look at you. You're doing the exact same thing you just talked about.
Well, he's not criticizing me, so it's easier to do. I had to reread the question a few times because I think maybe Dan is coming from a perspective. So, I mean, I'll just, like, tell you, at Liberty Baptist Church, you know, and he's almost, he says elders. So like, let's say that like the whole elder board, like not just an elder.
Yeah, I mean,
we removed, like, you know, we fired and disciplined an elder a few years ago who disqualified himself. But Dan is sort of speaking like, if you have elders who've sinned against a member or something like that, how do you get rid of them?
Yeah.
Well, like, we have a process of church discipline that was not exempt elders from that.
So that's right.
In that case, the other elders actually, put him up for church discipline. But this could be where members would make a motion, I suppose. Mm-hmm. If the elders, I guess he's saying, if there's no accountability externally, where's the accountability? And the accountability is the congregation.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So there may be like a, you know, it's maybe seemed like a nuclear option, but at our church, like if someone is making a charge against the elder board, y'all agree with false teaching, or you've all sinned against us, you've covered up abuse or something, I don't know. You might think, oh, well, like, that's a stalemate, because what could the in our bylaws, congregation could make a motion to remove the entire elder board, and then it would be up for a vote. There's a second, that'd be up for a vote. Like, so there's the potential that the whole church could vote to remove us all at once.
I'm teaching polity or like church governance, which is, because I'm a nerd, something I love teaching. I really love ecclesiology.
It's like keeping box scores for baseball.
Whenever I'm teaching ecclesiology to the undergrad level, so they've like largely never thought about it, and if they have, they don't like it or care. I like for them to, with every polity structure, whether it be like Episcopalianism, Presbyterianism, Congregationalism, I like for them to be able to answer at least two questions. One, in this polity model, how many offices are there? And two, who has the authority? Where are the keys? The keys of the kingdom. And as a Congregationalist myself, a committed Congregationalist, the answer to those questions are, there are two offices, the office of elder, the office of deacon, and the power is with the people, the congregation. They're the ones with the keys. Now, elders obviously have enough authority that Hebrews can say, submit to your elders, and that actually means something.
Right.
However, the power is with the people. So that, I think you're exactly right. If there is an elder or an elder team, an elder board, an elder council, whatever you guys call them, that is legitimately in sin, the congregation has the authority to do something about that. Right. I actually think I would want to flip the question on its head a little bit, that the congregational model seems to have the baked in goods necessary to do something about this. Because the power's actually in writing with the people of the church. You don't even have to go to an outside board who might end up siding with, you know, the elders or something like that.
When you're like looking at how hierarchies sometimes work, right? And I'm not trying to do, you know, standpoint epistemology or anything, or oppressed oppressor paradigm. But if the problem is you cannot, the congregation has no recourse because leadership is out of touch, what makes you think an external leadership board is automatically sympathetic to the congregation and not to the leaders that they have put in the in that church? It's almost, you know, and then who holds that board accountable?
Exactly.
I mean, it's like turtles on the way down. You know? It's just like, any way you slice it, there are, you know, sinful people involved.
That's right. Yeah. This is why meaningful membership and a real congregationalism is so significant.
And I guess to answer Dan's question from a different perspective, like, I guess if it's an elder, not just elder-led, but elder-governed church where the congregation does not have those recourses, right? So a Baptist church that does not have historic, you know, the congregational polity, which would really be out of step with Baptist tradition.
Not but, a Baptist church,
but, right, but let's say they're Credo Baptist and they're SBC, and there are churches like that.
Yeah, that's right.
And maybe Dan is speaking from that, you know, perspective. I guess the only recourse is that you leave. The church would have to leave and go to another church or something. So you still have some recourse, I guess, but not the same as if you actually can have a mechanism to remove those leaders. All right, this comes from Anonymous, another Anonymous via email.
It's a popular name.
Yeah, Anonymous asks, what advice would you give a newish convert when guiding his child and attempting to lovingly maintain relationships with lost family and friends? Anonymous gives some context. I started exploring Christianity 3 years ago Welcome aboard.
Yeah, praise the Lord.
Yeah. Now I'm convinced of his divinity. I assume he means Jesus. My best friend is gay. My father is a skeptic. My brother is a pagan. And my mother has a history of church hurt. My mother's leaning on me as a spiritual leader. When my mother requests that I pray before family meals, my father and brother respectfully bow their heads for her. I'm reading books to fill gaps in my theological understanding, but I feel woefully ill-equipped. Any advice?
I love this question. I really do.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't map onto my story exactly. The specifics aren't the same. But I was kind of the first shot across the bow in terms of like becoming a Christian in my family. And so it does map on a little bit of like, when that happens, you just become the spiritual guy in your family, whatever that means. So, you know, for years, you know, now it's like when Thanksgiving meal, it's like, hey, my nephew could pray or my cousin could pray or my dad could pray. That was not the case.
I always got asked at my in-laws at every meal because I was the pastor.
That's right.
I was a minister. So certainly his prayer is more holy, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's not that was not always the case that we had a plethora of people who could pray. It was always just me, you know, and I'll say, There are times where I think I'm doing this really poorly, and then there are times where I think, oh wow, there was shockingly some progress there. Mm. I remember one time I had a family member who has a wildly different sexual ethic than I do. Mm. And they posted on an article that I wrote. And I commented like, hey, I totally understand your question. And, you know, here's why I would continue saying the way I said it in the article. And they responded, I knew I could get a level-headed response from you. Yeah. And the Lord felt really encouraged by that. Like the Lord used that of like, hey, my like ability to not freak out over ideological differences is actually, I'm reaping some of that, you know. Because I have other family members who are Christians who it's like the moment they became Christians, they went and attacked all of the non-Christian family members. And now there's like no ability to witness there.
Yeah.
But my like slow approach of like being reasonable, trying to be in any given moment, the most level head in the room where I probably have the most convictions in the room and I'm probably the kindest in the room. If you can do both of those, you actually do buy some. Hey, he's never been unreasonable with me before. Now, I will say my error is sometimes I don't pull the trigger and I don't say the thing that's going to offend. And I have to do that sometimes.
Yeah, right.
You know, but I think that's where you have to know your family. Some families, it's like they would be respected if you just actually said, hey, you're wrong on this and we need to talk about it, you know. Where my family would not resonate well with that, you know. So, but me being reasonable, me being level-headed, not freaking out all the time, has actually gone really far with my family.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean they're all Christians. They're not. But the Lord has saved a number of people in my family over the last, you know, decade and a half. And I think this is maybe a part of that.
Yeah. There's, I think, something important to be seen when those times of tension occur, even outside your control, right? Anonymous may, he's seeking the peace. He wants to be loving. He's being gentle. You know, people will ask him questions, maybe in his family, like, do you actually believe this now? I believe this because of X, Y, and Z. Well, that's crazy. Like, why would you think that? Or that's offensive because it actually is diametrically opposed to how I live my life. And so you must not love me. And things get heated very quickly. And you may be thinking like, oh, man, even despite my best efforts, it's just because I believe this that suddenly I've created, but there's now this rift or this tension. Remember that Jesus promised that this would happen, you know, you know, he would divide families in some way. It's a consequence of an unbelieving family being invaded by the gospel in some way where someone, you know, changes the game plan by believing in Jesus.
Yes.
And Jesus even, you know, says like, we need to be willing to, he uses the word hate, you know, our family on account of him. And I don't think he means like you don't love your family, but the contrast to turn away from the direction, the vision of unbelief towards the belief in Christ, that it's that stark a contrast, I think, is what he's getting at with hate there. But essentially, you're going to reject their way of living, believing, et cetera, and embrace Jesus's way. And that's just going to create tension. there as well. So Jesus promised that this would happen. So it's not an aberration, and it's probably not because you did something wrong or yes. you're like, you made the misstep. And sometimes, you know, believers who are, they want their family to be one to Christ, they feel like they're walking on eggshells. Mm-hmm. And that's a good instinct to want to be gentle and loving and caring, but it's possible that like you're being too timid. It's possible that you're also, that you're taking on too much insecurity. Mm-hmm. You just need to, you need to pray a lot and trust the Lord with your witness in that regard. Anonymous, that's what I would, yep. you know, say to you is pray a lot. Keep growing in your faith. Keep loving your family. Don't take on the weight of these people all have to be converted because of my faithfulness. Like you can't carry that. Only the Lord can carry that. So don't take on more than you need to in terms of just like the pressure of changing people's hearts. And it's very likely that the Lord will use you, you know, to win others to the Lord, you know, to win others to himself, but you can't control somebody's belief or unbelief. So, you know, relinquish that burden, you know, put that burden on God. He is sovereign over that burden. And just keep growing in your faith, keep trusting, keep loving and serving, speaking the truth as you have opportunity. Like certainly, you know, don't shrink back from that. But to feel woefully ill-equipped, man, no one's more equipped in your family in this regard than you are. you're probably more equipped than you think you are, mm-hmm. especially 3 years in. Yeah, don't grow weary, as the word says, do not grow weary in doing good, for you will reap a harvest in due time. All right, final question. This comes from Jeff on Facebook. A little snarky. This is the first response to my social media ask, and it always irks me. I got a beef.
Oh, yeah?
My beef is when people don't give serious answers. I'm like, does anyone have any questions or topics they'd like us to cover? And the first wiseacre is Jeff going, what color is the mailbag? What color is the mailbag?
What color?
Well, it's I've got a deep philosophical answer.
You do.
It's the color of time.
Oh, wow.
It's the color of the number 7.
Okay.
It's what color?
Keep going.
What color do you want the mailbag to be? I think we should give this question the same amount of seriousness, our answer the same amount of seriousness as the question was yeah. given, which is a throwaway, Jeff just goofing around on Facebook, ruining my afternoon with his stupid reactionary, yeah. thought it was funny question. And I
sometimes thought, my daughter will come to me and say, Dad, I have a question. And I'll say, okay, but my answer is either going to be no, blue, or 3. You choose.
Oh, interesting.
And here it would work.
Okay.
It's blue.
How many persons in the divine Godhead?
That's right. That's right.
Well, yeah. It's sort of like, you know, what does the number 8 smell like, right? That's what the color is, the mailbag. It's an esoteric, ephemeral, nonsensical question.
Wow.
Because, Jeff, you know there is no physical mailbag. I don't walk in here with a bag.
But why not now?
You bozo. I don't have a sack.
Hopefully you know Jeff.
I have no idea who Jeff is. He's just a jerk on Facebook.
Oh my word. Jeff, you are not a jerk on Facebook.
Jeff left this dumb question. He's got to appreciate this answer. This is what you get.
Wow.
So I'm going to load that mailbag up with soda cans and swing it at your head, Jeff.
Wow.
That's what I'm going to do. No, I'm sure Jeff is a nice guy.
I'm sure he's great.
There's no mailbag.
Jeff has
the questions
Jeff,
come in.
He puts his card back.
I put them in an email. It's a metaphorical mailbag.
Yeah, a metaphorical mailbag.
So I don't know.
What
do you want me, what do you want me to call it, Jeff?
That's a good podcast name.
It's the metaphorical FTC mailbag. Emailed Questions Day. Stupid. Yeah. We're gonna call it mailbag.
I like it.
Okay. Don't ever ask this question again. If you enjoy the podcast, dear listener, give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, or YouTube, where you watch your favorite podcasts. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church.